I thought it might be helpful just at the outset to take 3 or 4 minutes to give you a very broad overview of the interrelationships between psychology and religion, as psychologists have written about them these last few years, and then see if we can narrow our focus a little bit for the talks that I'm going to present during these next 3 days. It seems to me there are about a half dozen or so ways in which people have written about the relationship of psychology and religion. And let me first just identify what these half dozen or so ways are. One are research studies of the religious beliefs of psychologists, or the religious non-beliefs, and the attitudes towards psychology of religious people. That is, what are the attitudes of those in psychology and those who are deeply religious toward those respective areas? That would be one area in which people have investigated the relationship of psychology and religion. A second area in which people have done research is to take religion as an object of psychological analysis. This is the psychology of religion. And so we have psychological analyses of religious phenomena such as conversion and prayer. A third topic has to do with religion as a predictor of human behavior. What are the differences, if any, between self-described Christians and non-Christians, for example, in drug use, in sexual behavior, in altruism, in racial attitudes? Such are the questions that have been asked in a vast area of research on the relationship between religious belief and people's social attitudes and behavior. Then the fourth area in which there has been, an active interface between psychology and religion has to do with the application of religion in counseling and psychotherapy. And as many of you are aware, there is a very active Christian counseling movement now. There are a number of seminaries that are offering master's or even PhD programs in counseling and in the mental health professions. Then a fifth area of, active recent dialogue among those interested both in psychology and religion has to do with a religious, especially a Christian critique of the assumptions and values of mainstream academic psychology. And that's the first topic we're going to get into a little bit tonight, looking at a kind of Christian view or evaluation of what's going on in mainstream academic psychology. And then the sixth thing will be really the subject of tomorrow's lecture, which is noting some parallels between psychological and religious descriptions of human nature. Now, I think you probably ought to know that I am not a mental health professional, and I'm not a philosopher. And so as we have conversations during the next 2 or 3 days, it would probably be well for you to remember that. What I am is a research psychologist, specifically a social psychologist, and it's been my privilege the last half dozen years or so to spend nearly all my time reviewing the literature of my subdiscipline, social psychology, and now in the last 3 years for a book that came out in February of the entire discipline of psychology. So I don't know much about anything, at least outside of social psychology, but I think I know a little bit about a lot of things that research psychologists have been doing in America's colleges and universities during the last decade or two. So that will be our focus tomorrow, looking at some striking and intriguing parallels between what research psychologists are concluding about human nature and what Christians believe. So tonight we're going to look at some evaluation, kind of an overview of current trends in psychology. Tomorrow it's some parallels. And then on Sunday, and this would be kind of the last thing, area of dialogue between psychology and religion, at applications of psychological research. And I've just picked three kind of unrelated topics to do some, to use as examples of how research psychologists are applying their findings in some, I think, practically useful ways to people who are in the church. And we'll be looking particularly, just to give you a little preview, first at how the methods of psychological research can be applied. And I picked as an example the concern that's been voiced by many that there exists in rock music a strong satanic influence that exists in the form of backward messages that are embedded in rock records. And so we're going to take a research psychologist look at that particular controversial question. And then we'll also look at, from my own discipline of social psychology, and I'll try to suggest some simple practical keys for producing memorable sermons. And finally, we'll look in both Christian and psychological perspective at how people, including how we ourselves, cope with our economic situation and how we feel about our incomes. So those will be three applications. Again, that's the structure, and I think by looking first at a kind of evaluative overview of psychology, and then second at some intriguing parallels between psychological research findings and Christian belief, and finally at some practical applications, we can kind of get a smattering of the relationship between psychological research and Christian belief. Now, before we go on any further this evening, let me just try your patience a bit with a little demonstration that I'll make reference to later. If you'll turn the outline over, what I'd like you to do is simply read, and if you have a pencil or pen, take a couple moments to answer the questions on the other side, social psychology and so forth, in a sentence or two, answer this question. Wait, just answer the questions on the page, and just, I don't need more than a sentence or two, but just write your and check your answers to those questions. But I'm also aware that many of my fellow Christians, perhaps many of you, certainly I suspect many of your colleagues or many of your friends or fellow church members, are sharply critical and suspicious of mainstream psychology. For example, my philosopher friend Nick Woltersdorf has suggested that the fundamental reason Christians in academic scientific psychology begin to talk about the integration of faith and psychology is that when they work in contemporary psychology, there are things there that bother them. There are developments there that make them feel uneasy. It appears to them that their Christian faith is in tension with certain developments in psychology. Such Christians have given us a number of recent books and articles that lament the assumptions and methodologies of mainstream psychology that even imply that those of us who work in academic psychology are sorcerer's apprentices, to use the title of one recent book, and that propose a distinctly Christian perspective on psychology, or even a Christian psychology. Now, as I scan these critiques, I find myself at times agreeing and provoked to wonder how I, as a Christian psychologist, can intentionally and at all times be Christian, even while writing for the secular marketplace, which has been my main mission these last few years. But at other times, I wince, for the critiques seem to be perpetuating myths about psychology, myths that simply don't square with the psychology of the 1980s as I observe it. So I thought this evening that we would take a look at current trends in psychology by considering some of these myths. I have put down on the paper 9 myths that I think exist and could do well to be refuted, but the ASA committee has wisely suggested that in the interest of time, we consider 5 of these. But I leave the rest on the paper so that if in question and answer time afterward or in discussion later, you'd like to get into some discussion of other things, others of these myths are there as topics for discussion. So we're going to skip, or just mention very lightly, numbers 2, 4, 7, and 8, addressing the remainder. I should say in advance that, like many cultural myths, there are elements of truth in each one of these, which is why I don't call them falsehoods, but myths. Each is, I think, to some extent true. But the reality in each case is different than a simple version of the myth would suggest. Now, the first two myths on the sheet represent the extreme ends of a continuum of attitudes regarding psychological science. And the longest point I'm going to make is in response to this first myth, so rest assured the rest is going to go much faster. This first myth is that psychological science is a purely objective fact-gathering enterprise. If you've taken introductory psychology, you may remember this one from your very first week in the course. Psychology is, we tell our students, the science of observable behavior. It uses repeatable experiments to evaluate hypotheses and therefore to verify truths, or more often to refute falsehoods. This myth, like each of the others, is, I think, partially correct. Psychology's empirical methods, its reliance on observation and experiment, are its distinct contribution to human understanding. And that's why I want to illustrate those methods in this little mini-talk on satanic messages in rock music on Sunday afternoon. But the reality is that psychological science is not so objective as our textbooks have often made it seem. First, to an extent that is not true of other scientific disciplines, such as my undergraduate field of chemistry, psychologists' work is penetrated by their values. Values influence our choice of research topics, first of all, whether we choose to study worker productivity or worker morale, sex discrimination or sex differences, conformity or independence. Values influence our definitions of mental health and disorder, of self-actualization and fulfillment, of moral maturity and sexual health. And values influence our psychological language, whether, for example, we call sexually restrained individuals erotophobic, as today's sex researchers commonly do, or sexually conservative. Whether we label those who say only nice things about themselves on personality inventories as high self-esteem, or as we can also call the same set of responses, defensive. Whether those who respond to social cues should be congratulated for their social sensitivity or disparaged for their tractable conformity. Second, psychologists' presuppositions guide their research and their theory construction. We can illustrate the point with just a simple little exercise. For the next 3 seconds, observe. Perhaps you're wondering, observe what? And of course, that's the point. Our observations are always directed. We're looking for something. We're checking some hypothesis. We're evaluating some pre-existing idea that we have. Just before I came over here, over to the evening meal, I read an article on the history of parapsychological investigations and the kinds of people that tended to go into parapsychology. And this historian of parapsychology was maintaining that these were, for example, the founders of the British Society for Psychical Research, which is the original parapsychological society, were almost entirely people who had abandoned Christianity, no longer believed in God, as was also the case for most of those people who supported and funded J.B. Rhind during his early parapsychological research days, and yet felt the longing for something within themselves that would guarantee immortality. And if they could validate through scientific methods some evidence of a non-physical reality to human nature that was essential to themselves, not something given by some god they no longer believed in, then there was some meaning still left to life for them. And so regardless of what results they received, they were so driven by this need to believe that it really drove their conclusions. So this particular author was contending. And certainly it's true in your fields, I suspect, as well as in mine, and certainly in our everyday experience as well, that our preconceptions operate sort of like a flashlight by selectively bringing out some part of the world, some part into view. Now, we all know that, and that's not controversial, but the extent to which our preconceptions influence what we notice and how we interpret it is really dramatically demonstrated, I think, in some recent experiments. These experiments reveal some of the cognitive mechanisms through which bias operates, and it affects, I suspect, not just psychological theorizing, but also religious belief systems and maybe work in your own fields of scientific endeavor. One set of experiments on what is called the phenomenon of confirmation bias reveals that our information gathering is strongly biased to seek confirmation of our pre-existing ideas. In one experiment, a British researcher, P.C. Wasson, gave people a sheet of paper. They had the numbers 2, 4, 6 written at the top. And then he had a couple columns which were written out, conforms or does not conform. And he checked conforms for this first set of numbers, for these three numbers, conformed to a rule that Wasson had in mind. Now he invited people to generate additional sets of numbers. Imagine yourself as one of his subjects. You generate three numbers, any three numbers you want, and then, if I were the experimenter, I will check whether or not those numbers that you've written down conform or do not conform to the rule that I have in mind. You keep generating numbers. Keep testing until you're sure you know the rule that is guiding my checking whether or not your numbers conform or do not conform. When you're sure you know the rule, announce it. Well, what Wasson found was that 4 times out of 5, people became sure, absolutely confident, that they had ascertained what in fact was not the rule he had in mind. In this particular example, his rule was any 3 ascending numbers. But what people tended to do is form some hypothesis. Maybe, for example, you thought it was counting by 2s. Well, of course, you could check that out. You could write down 10, 12, 14. You could write down minus 6, minus 4, minus 2. You could write down 101, 103, 105. Well, each time, Wasson would say, yep, that illustrates the rule. Yep, that illustrates the rule. And so then you announce it. Finally, you're absolutely sure. It's counting by 2s. Nope, that's not it. And people would 4 times out of 5 be stunned. What they had done, of course, is formed an erroneous idea about what the truth was, then search only for confirming evidence, only attempting to confirm their pre-existing ideas. What the human mind is not predisposed to do naturally is to try and disconfirm those ideas that it carries into research or into life. Such experiments indicate, then, that we're really more eager to verify our beliefs and hunches than to try to disprove them. And the phenomenon is known in psychology today as the confirmation bias. Other experiments illustrate what is now called the belief perseverance phenomenon. The belief perseverance phenomenon reveals our resistance to disconfirming evidence even when we're confronted with it. In one such study, Charles Lord and his colleagues showed Stanford University students, half of whom favored and half of whom opposed capital punishment, two studies that were relevant to the capital punishment issue. One study confirmed and the other disconfirmed the students' pre-existing beliefs about the crime-deterring effectiveness of capital punishment. Both the proponents and the opponents of capital punishment, as you might suspect, readily accepted the evidence that confirmed their view, but found all sorts of flaws in the evidence that disconfirmed their view. Thus, and this is really the startling result of this experiment, showing the two sides an identical body of mixed, ambiguous evidence served not to narrow their disagreement, but to accentuate it. For each found support for their pre-existing views and left the experiment feeling even more strongly of what they felt coming into the experiment. This finding, I think, and many others like it, illustrating the belief perseverance phenomenon, helps us understand why in both religion and science, ambiguous evidence often fuels rather than extinguishes the fires of debate. If you approach scriptures on a topic like, what does the Bible say about the role of women? You often tend to find that depending on your pre-existing ideas about that subject, you may interpret and find very different kinds of evidence in Scripture. Likewise, as psychologists of a liberal or conservative bent approach issues like to what extent do genes contribute to intelligence or to gender differences, there tends to be an interesting correspondence between people's political views and the conclusions that they draw from the literature on the effect of genes versus environment. But sometimes, of course, the evidence clearly fails to support our hypotheses. What is more, sometimes the very basis on which we form the belief is totally discredited. In such cases, do we then give up the belief? Well, sometimes, but not necessarily, is the suggestion of some more recent experiments. In some of these, Lee Ross out at Stanford and his collaborators have discovered that it can be surprisingly difficult to demolish a false belief once people imagine reasons why it might be true. For example, in one study, they invited people to consider whether risk-prone people make good or bad firefighters. Half the people were told about a risk-taker who was an excellent firefighter and a cautious person who was a poor firefighter. The other half of the people were told about the reverse. In either case, people were asked to surmise why those findings might have been obtained. Now, just imagine yourself again as a subject in this experiment. If you're shown a couple of cases, one in which a risky person is a good firefighter and a cautious person does not do well at firefighting, might you not conjure up an explanation? Well, why would that? Maybe risky people are braver. Maybe they're more likely to, with courage, rush into a burning building and rescue the occupants. That would be a very plausible explanation for that. Remember, the other half of the people were given the opposite finding and asked to explain that. And of course, they too could come up with a plausible explanation for that. Maybe cautious people think before they act. I mean, they're not so impulsive. I mean, they're a little more well-reasoned, and thus they're more competent firefighters, okay? Now, what Ross then did is totally demolish the foundation for these beliefs that he had now implanted. Truthfully, he told them, I just made up those cases for purposes of this experiment. To tell you the truth, I really don't have the vaguest idea whether risky or cautious people make better firefighters. But before he left the experiment, he would be curious to know what they really felt. What they really felt was exactly the belief that they had just explained, even though the basis for establishing that belief and that explanation had been totally demolished by the experimenter. Why? It's because the people still retained their explanations for the belief, even though the reason for having adopted that belief in the first place no longer existed for them. Paradoxically, then, and this is the provocative conclusion that these researchers draw, the more closely we examine our preconceptions, that might be our scientific theories, our religious beliefs, or whatever, and come to appreciate why they might be true, the more closed we become to cogent discrediting information. Once ideas are formed and justified as plausible, it takes more compelling evidence to change them than it did to create them in the first place. If the experiment fails to confirm our theory, we're more likely to question the experiment than the theory once we've explained a rationale for why the theory ought to be true. Once we invent an explanation as to why Sarah is prone to depression or why Sam is so hostile to his family, we become more resistant to evidence that contradicts the theory, even if that same evidence would have led us not to adopt the theory in the first place had we had it earlier. And indeed, by the way, there is considerable evidence that these cognitive biases affect clinical judgment as well as scientific judgment. And why are our preconceptions so prone to error in the first place? Cognitive psychologists tell us that because our information processing capacities are limited, we attend selectively to the world around us and form mental representations, or schemas, to use the current jargon, that are never perfect replicas of the world as it is out there. These schemas, or these knowledge representations, reflect our needs and propensities as well as what's out there. There are constructions. There are constructions that both represent and misrepresent the world as it is out there, and that then serve as spectacles through which we perceive and interpret the world. So, to summarize this rather long response to the first myth, the penetrating power of our values, which affects us in psychology in so many ways, the values from which we begin, together with our tendencies to seek evidence that confirms our constructed beliefs, and to persevere in our beliefs even in the face of disconfirming evidence, all this means that psychological science is most assuredly not a dispassionate, purely objective, fact-gathering enterprise. And I think these cognitive mechanisms have enormous implications for other realms of study beyond psychology as well. So far, then, I've sided with the critics of psychology who have called attention to the limitations of our empirical methods. In the second myth, which in the interest of time I'm not going to go deeply into, the point is made from the other end of the continuum, that psychological science is or ought to be a purely subjective kind of enterprise. And this point, by the way, is made in strikingly parallel fashion by three different groups of critics who are kind of outside the camp of mainstream academic psychology. I've been at conferences with all three groups, and it's deja vu when I go from one to the other. One are the Marxist critics, who see subtle capitalist values embedded and assumptions embedded in the very, very concepts and language of psychology. Another set of criticism is the very same point about masculine bias from feminist psychologists. And finally, there are criticisms of secular humanism and so forth from conservative Christian psychologists, but all of which in philosophical language are often making exactly the very same point. And the response to that is that that's true to a point, but it's also true, as I'm going to emphasize later, that things are not entirely arbitrary, and that the empirical methods have produced enormous fruit that purely subjective kinds of and intuitive kinds of approaches to the discipline have not. Skipping then to the third myth, that there are three schools of modern psychology: psychoanalytic, behavioristic, and humanistic. This is a relatively easy and simple one to deal with, although I think it's important to do so, because we continue to hear it from time to time in talks that people give about psychology or in popularizations of psychology, which assume that psychology is synonymous with one or more of these three schools. I think, for example, of Paul Witz's provocative and useful but mistitled book, Psychology as Religion, which is actually not about psychology at all in general, but about humanistic psychology, which is a very small part of the whole field of psychology. We even still occasionally hear this myth from those who continue to whip the dead horse of behaviorism, or who trumpet that psychology is at last moving from the old views of Freud and Skinner to a more personalistic and humanistic point of view. Well, the reality is that few academic psychologists today would describe themselves as members of any one of these three schools, or even into some eclectic combination of them. At my own institution, Hope College, there are 9 of us in the psychology department. There is one person that would call himself a humanistic psychologist, no one who would call himself or herself a behavioristic psychologist, and no one who would say they're psychoanalytically or inclined even in the slightest. So I just use us as an example, and my colleagues that I know at other academic institutions, the same would be true of them as well. And for that matter, apart from the chapters on maybe conditioning and personality theory and psychotherapy, little of the content of an introductory psychology textbook could be described as psychoanalytic or as behavioristic or as humanistic. To be sure, academic psychology retains the empirical orientation that has characterized behaviorism, but not many psychologists any longer believe that psychology should, as the behaviorists urged, study overt behavior without references to cognitive processes or mental processes. The name of the game today in psychology is cognition. Few textbooks any longer define psychology as the science of behavior. Almost every one of them define it today as the science of behavior and mental processes. From the late 1960s to the present, psychologists' motto could, I think, well have been minding our business. There are a number of books out that provide really very captivating summaries of this new research in cognitive psychology, as you find it in the experimental and developmental and social areas of psychology. Journalist Morton Hunt's book, The Universe Within, by the way, is one such very well-done book, which incidentally is also an attack on the remnants of behaviorism in American psychology. The fourth myth that psychology should replace its empirical methods with non-empirical, subjective, intuitive methods that are more attuned to a truly and fully human